Tamar said. Nikolai is out.
Impossible,
Zoya protested, though she was already reaching for her boots. Tamar's brows rose as Zoya tossed a coat over her nightdress. Cobwebs of silver silk that flickered like lightning in a storm cloud when the lamplight struck the sheer fabric just right.
Who did you dress for tonight?
She asked.
Myself, snapped Zoya.
Do we know where he's headed?
Tolya saw him fly west toward Balakirev.
Anyone else?
I don't think so. No alarm sounded, but we can't be sure. We're lucky this didn't happen in the summer.
When the sun never properly set, and anyone would be able to see a monster in the skies.
How?
Zoya asked, as she nudged a panel in the wall and it slid open to reveal a long flight of stairs. When she'd had her chambers refurbished, she'd had a tunnel dug to connect it to the network of passages beneath Os Alta.
Those chains are reinforced with Grisha steel, if he's gotten stronger.
They weren't broken, said Tamar from behind her.
They were unlocked.
Zoya stumbled and nearly toppled down the stairs.
Unlocked? Then someone knew Nikolai's secret.
Had sought to sabotage their work to keep it undiscovered? The implications were overwhelming. Long moments later, they were pushing into the basement of the convent of Sancta Elisabetta. Tolya waited in the gardens with three horses.
Tell me, Zoya said as she and Tamar mounted.
I heard glass breaking, Tolya replied. When I ran inside, I saw the king take flight from the window casement. No one had come or gone through his door.
Damn it.
Then had the monster somehow managed to pick the locks? Zoya kicked her horse into a gallop. She had 1,000 questions, but they could worry about how Nikolai had gotten free once they'd retrieved him. They rode hard over the bridge and through the streets of the lower town. At a signal to the guards, they thundered through the gates and Os Alta's famous double walls. How far had Nikolai gotten? How far would he go? Better that he flew away from the city, away from anywhere heavily populated. Zoya reached for the invisible currents that flowed around them, higher and higher, seeking the disruption on the wind that was Nikolai. It was not only the weight and size of him, but the very wrongness of him that brushed against her power.
Merzost. Abomination.
The taint of something monstrous in his blood.
He's still headed west,
she said, feeling his presence bleed across her senses.
He's in Balakirev.
A pretty little spot. One of the favorite places for Grisha to visit for sleigh rides and festivals in better times. They slowed their horses as they approached the outskirts of town, and the dirt roads gave way to cobblestones. Balakirev slept, its windows dark and houses quiet. Here or there, Zoya saw a lantern lit through the glass, a mother tending to a fussy infant, a clerk working late into the pre-dawn hours. She turned her awareness to the skies and gestured the twins forward. Nikolai was moving toward the town center. The main square was silent, lined by the courthouse, the town hall, the grand offices of the local governor. Stone paths radiated from a large fountain, where Zoya knew the women would come to do their washing. A statue of Sankt Juris stood at its center, his lance piercing the heart of a great dragon as water cascaded from the back of the beast's wings. Zoya had always hated that particular story. The great warrior Juris seemed like a big bully.
The roof, she whispered, pointing to the town hall. I'll watch the perimeter.
Tamar and Tolya slipped silently from their horses, shackles in hand, and disappeared into the building. If Nikolai took flight, she could try to bring him down or at least track him. But dawn was coming on. They had to move quickly. She waited in the shadows, eyes trained on the spires of the town hall. The night felt too still. Zoya had the uncomfortable sense that she was being watched, but the shops and buildings surrounding the square showed no signs of life. High above, the roof line of the town hall seemed to shift. A shadow broke from the roof, wings spread against the moonlit sky. Zoya lifted her hands and prepared to bring Nikolai down, but he circled once, then settled on the towering spike of the church's bell tower.
Damn it. Tolia and Tamar would be racing up the stairs of the town hall, only to find their quarry escaped. If Zoya attempted the church stairs, Nikolai could well make another leap and be long gone before she reached the top. The sky was already turning gray, and if he broke for open countryside, they might never catch him. There was no time to hesitate. She eyed the open notches in the stonework of the bell tower. Even with her amplifier, she'd never manage the control necessary for flight. Only Grisha, flush with the effects of Jurdaparem, could accomplish that feat. "This is going to hurt," she muttered, and spun her hands in tight circles, summoning the current, then arced her arms. The gust hit her from behind, lofting her upward. It took all her will to resist the urge to pinwheel her arms and let the wind take her higher. She thrust her hand forward, and the gust threw her toward the gap in the stone. Too hard, too fast. There was no time to adjust her aim. Zoya covered her head and face, then grunted as her shoulder cracked against the edge of a column. She tumbled to the floor of the bell tower in a graceless heap and rolled to her back, trying to get her bearings. There, high above, perched in the eaves. She caught the glint of the monster's eyes in the dark. She could just make out his shape. His chest was bare. His torn trousers slung low on his hips. His taloned feet curved over the beams of the bell tower. A low growl reached her, seemed to reverberate through the floorboards. Something was different tonight. He was different. "Oh, saints," she realized. "He's hungry." In the past, Zoya had been slower to find Nikolai, locating him after he'd hunted and fed. "He's never killed a human before," she reminded herself, then amended, "that we know of." But she felt in her bones that tonight she was the prey. Like hell. She pushed to her feet and hissed in a breath at the throb in her shoulder. She'd dislocated it, maybe broken the bone. Pain rolled through her in a wave that set her stomach churning. Her right arm was useless. She'd have only her left arm to summon with. But if Adric could do it, so could she. "Nikolai," she said sternly. The growl stopped, then picked up again, lower and louder than before. A tendril of fear uncurled in her belly. Was this what it was to be a small creature pinned helpless in the wood? "Nikolai," she snapped, not letting her terror enter her voice. She thought it might be a very bad thing if he knew she was afraid. "Get down here." The growl rippled and huffed, almost like a laugh. Before she could make sense of that, he launched himself at her. Zoya threw up her hand, and a blast of wind pummeled the creature, but her attempt had only half the strength of her usual summoning. It drove him backward, and he struck the wall, but with little force. She saw the monster register her injury, her weakness. It drew in a long breath, muscles tensing. How many nights had she kept it from its fun? How long had it been waiting for a chance to hurt her? She needed help. "Tolia," she shouted. "Tamar!" But could they even hear her at such a distance? Zoya eyed the bell. The monster lunged. She dove right and screamed as her injured shoulder hit the slats, but threw her other arm up with all the force she could muster, begging the storm to answer. Wind seized the bell and sent its massive metal shell swinging. The clapper struck, a reverberant clang that shuddered through her skull and made the monster snarl. The bell struck a second time, far more weakly, before it slowed its arc. Zoya was sweating now, her pain turning her vision black at the edges. She dragged herself toward the wall. Nikolai, the monster, was prowling toward her in a low crouch, its clawed feet silent over the slats of the floor, the movement eerily inhuman. It was Nikolai, and yet it was not Nikolai. The elegant lines of its face were the same, but its eyes were black as ink. The shadows of its wings seemed to pulse and seethe. "Nikolai," she said again, "I'm going to be furious if you try to eat me, and you know what I'm like when I'm mad." Its lips drew back in a smile. There was no other word for it. revealing needle-sharp fangs that gleamed like shards of obsidian. Whatever was stalking her was not her king.
"Captain," she tried. "Sturmhund!"
Nothing. It stalked closer.
"Sobatchka,"
she said. Puppy. The nickname he'd had as a child, one she'd never used with him before.
"Stop this."
From somewhere far below, she heard a door slam.
"Tolia?
Tamar?" It didn't matter. They weren't going to make it in time. Soya could summon lightning, but without both arms to control the current, she knew she would kill him. She raised her arm again. The gust drove the creature back, but its claws gripped the wooden floor and it plowed forward, wings pinned tight to its body, dark gaze focused on her. It batted her good arm aside, hard enough that she thought it might have broken that bone too. The wind fell away and the monster's wings flared wide. It opened its mouth and spoke.
"Zoya."
She flinched. The monster did not speak. It could not. But it wasn't even the shock of speech coming from the creature's lips that so frightened her. That was not Nikolai's voice. It was soft, cool as glass. Familiar. No, it couldn't be. Fear was clouding her mind. The creature's lips parted. Its teeth gleamed. It seized her hair and yanked her head back as she struggled. It was going to tear her throat out. Its lips brushed the skin of her neck. A thousand thoughts crowded into her mind. She should have brought a weapon. She shouldn't have relied on her power. She shouldn't have believed she wasn't afraid to die. She shouldn't have believed that Nikolai would not harm her. The door to the bell tower slammed open and Tamar was there, Tolia behind her. Tamar's axes flew. One lodged in the creature's shoulder, the other into the meat of one of its wings. The thing turned on them, snarling, and Tolia's hand shot out. Zoya watched, torn between lingering dread and fascination as the creature's legs buckled. It growled, then fell silent as Tolia slowed its heart and sent the monster into unconsciousness. Zoya rose, cradling her dislocated arm, and looked down at the thing on the floorboards as its claws receded, the dark veins retracting and fading, its wings dissolving into shreds of shadow. The King of Ravka lay on the bell tower floor, golden hair disheveled, boyish and bleeding.
"Are you all right?" asked Tamar.
"Yes," Zoya lied.
"Zoya."
The sound of his voice in that moment, smooth as glass, neither human nor inhuman. Did that mean that whatever was inside him was not the mindless monster they'd assumed? It hadn't just been hungry. There had been something vengeful in its desire. Would Nikolai have woken with her blood on his lips?
"You know what this means," said Tamar.
They couldn't control him. The palace was no longer safe, and Nikolai was no longer safe in it. And right now, ambassadors, dignitaries, noblemen, and wealthy merchants were packing their best clothes and preparing to travel to Osalta, to say nothing of the eligible princesses and hopeful noblewomen who accompanied them.
"We've invited emissaries from every country to witness this horror," said Tolia,
"to watch Nikolai descend into bloodlust, to play audience as a king became more monster than man." Zoya had given her life to the Second Army, to a dream that they could build something better. She had believed that if her country was strong enough, the world might change for her kind. Now that dream was collapsing. Zoya thought of the stories Nina had told them, of the prison at the Ice Court. She thought of the Kergud emerging from the skies to steal Grisha from the safety of their lands. She remembered bodies littering the grounds of the little palace the night of the Darkling's attack. She would not let it happen again. She refused. Zoya took a breath and slammed her shoulder back into place, ignoring the jolt of nausea that came with the pain. "We find a cure," she said. "Or Ravka falls." Chapter 8. Nina.
"I don't like leaving Leonie behind," said Adric.
his solemn voice like the tolling of a particularly forlorn bell.
They're hardly friendly at the convent, and she doesn't speak the language.
Nina and Edric had made their way out of the valley, the sledge pulled behind their two mounts.
A hard wind at their backs. Nina rode side saddle, her heavy skirts gathered behind her.
She wasn't much of a rider to begin with, and this concession to Fjerdan's sensibilities was one of the most challenging elements of her cover. As they traveled farther from the town, the whispers rose in her head as if in protest. Now that she knew the dead had brought her to Gafala, the sounds seemed to have grown clearer, the high, sweet voices of the lost tugging at her thoughts. She hadn't told Adric and Leonie about the graves at the factory yet. The incident by the eastern gate had left her too shaken.
Leonie will be fine, said Nina, turning her attention to Adric. She's resourceful and she knows how to lie low. Besides, we'll be back by midday tomorrow.
Adric said nothing, and Nina added, cosseting her isn't going to win you any points. The chill had made Adric's skin rosy beneath his freckles, and he looked a bit like a sulky actor whose cheeks had been rouged for a play.
She's a soldier under my command. I would never cross that line.
She won't be under your command when this mission is over, Adric, and it's obvious she likes you.
She does?
He sounded disconsolate over the news. Nina wasn't fooled. She adjusted the straps of her pack.
To my great astonishment.
You like me too, Zenek. Must be my sunny outlook.
Adric, if the choice is between taking orders from you or Zoyana Zielinski, you're always going to win.
His breath plumed in the cold air.
I used to be completely in love with her.
Weren't we all? Even when she's slicing you in two with a few well-chosen words, it's hard to focus on anything but how good she looks doing it.
Appalling, Adric mused. I once saw a student set fire to his own hair because he was so busy looking at Zoya. She didn't even spare him a second glance.
Nina fixed Adric with a contemptuous stare, and in her most disdainful Zoya voice drawled, Someone throw a bucket on that idiot before he burns down the palace.
He shuddered.
That was far too convincing.
He consulted his map as they reached a crossroads.
Zoya was nice to look at,
he said as he led them farther west.
But there was more to it. She was the only one who treated me the same after I lost my arm.
Horribly?
She couldn't have shown me more contempt. Her insults were a lot easier to bear than Nadia constantly fussing over me.
That's what sisters do, I assume. You were just as much of a mother hen when we all came back from the fold.
They'd both been children, really. Nina had been a student at the Grisha school when they were all evacuated to the orphanage at Karemsen. But Adric had begged to go with his sister, to fight beside the Sun Summoner. He hadn't been there when the Darkling took Nina and the other students hostage.
I wasn't worried about you, said Adric. If you'd all died and I'd been the only one to leave school, can you imagine how tiring it would have been to live with the guilt?
Nina made herself laugh, but she knew all about guilt. She often wondered why she'd survived so much. Capture by the Druskella. Shipwreck. Kaz Brekker's mad heists. And the ordeal of Parem. She was the only Grisha to have lived through a dose of the drug.
What had made that possible? Was it that particular strain of Jurda Parem?
Was it her desire to spite Jarl Broom and his witch hunters by surviving? Chance, fortune, fate. She didn't know what name to give to it. Sometimes it felt like Matthias had kept her in his world through the sheer force of his will.
I failed you, Matthias. I wasn't strong enough to save you.
Little red bird, every day you choose the work of living. Every day you choose to go on. There is no failure here, Nina.
Zoya's a better leader than I expected,
admitted Adric,
even if I'd never tell her so.
Can you imagine? You might as well ask her if she wants to snuggle. General Zoya Nazielinski does not need or want our approval.
They fell into silence as the sun rose higher in the sky, the sledge rumbling over the ground. If it snowed, they would have to change the runners, but hopefully they would be back to Gafala before the weather turned. It was a meager funeral procession, and Nina couldn't help but think Matthias deserved more. Something full of pomp and ceremony, a funeral fit for a hero, even if his people believed he was a traitor.
I have been made to protect you. Even in death, I will find a way.
His voice was too clear now, too strong, because this was their final parting. Because once Matthias was in the ground, he would belong to Jill. She wasn't sure she could do it. She couldn't bear the thought of abandoning his body to the cold earth, to the dark.
Let me go to my god.
She wished Inej were here beside her, that the wraith were somewhere in all this silence. Nina longed for her stillness, her kindness. She was grateful to Adric, but he hadn't known Matthias. And he didn't really know Nina either. Not anymore. When at last they reached the fork of the river, they set up camp, a simple canvas tent lined with animal skins to keep the cold out. They made a fire, watered their horses, and sat down to a plain meal of tea and salt cod that Nina had to force herself to swallow. If anyone passed by, Adric and Nina planned to say they were on their way to Malsk to show off their wares. The sledge was stocked with plenty of rifle loaders, but Nina doubted they'd have to offer any explanations. Like so much of Fjarda, this place was desolate and empty. The little towns like flowers, unlikely blooms in the snow. Adric took a flask from his pocket, poured a small amount of black fluid into a copper cup, and contemplated it skeptically. What is that exactly?
I just know it's distilled from pine tar. One of the fishermen said it was good for fighting the cold.
He took a sip, and instantly began coughing and pounding his chest.
Saints, that's disgusting.
Maybe they just mean it kills you, so you don't have to worry about the cold anymore.
Or maybe they just like selling overpriced misery to tourists.
He offered her the flask, which Nina was quick to decline. For a while they sat staring at the waters of the river rushing past. At last he said,
"You never told me how he died."
Nina wasn't certain what to say, or if she wanted to say anything at all. The specifics of the Ketterdam auction were unknown to most in Ravka, even among the Grisha, and Nina doubted Adric would be thrilled to discover she'd been running with a gang of criminals.
"I don't really know. We were working together in Ketterdam. The worst of the mission was over. We thought we were all safe. But then Matthias showed up, bleeding. He'd been shot."
He'd found his way to her, despite the fatal wound, despite the pain he was in, for one last kiss, for a final goodbye.
There were Druskella in the city, and they certainly had their reasons for wanting Matthias dead, but we all had prices on our heads. People were hungry for our blood, and the streets were a holy mess.
She could still see his blood staining his shirt, feel the soft stubble of his nape beneath her fingertips. His hair had just begun to grow out properly, thick and golden.
"He wouldn't tell me who was responsible," she said.
Matthias hadn't wanted to burden her with that. He'd known she would strike out in her grief. But he should have understood that the mystery of his death would punish her. She'd thought her new mission working with the Hringsa in Fjarda, getting Grisha to freedom, would help ease her grief and her guilt. But she felt no better than she had at the start of it all.
"It eats at me.
I know that feeling."
Adric took another sip from his flask and winced at the taste.
"Vengeance was all that drove me at the end of the war. I wanted the Darkling to pay for my arm, for the lives of my friends. I wanted him dead."
"And you got your wish."
"And yet, my arm didn't grow back. None of my friends came back to life."
"I could help with that," Nina said,
and was relieved when Adric laughed his dry, reluctant chuckle. Some Grisha blanched at any mention of her new power. She'd been a heartrender once, felt the pulse of the world beating along with her heart. Perem had changed her. Nina had felt like a fraud sitting beneath the golden dome in the little palace, wearing her red kefta. She could no longer manipulate the living, hear the flow of their blood or the song of their cells. But the dead did her bidding, and she supposed she did their bidding too. She'd come to Gafala, after all. Nina finished the last of her tea. She could sense Edric waiting. She knew it was time. Maybe laying Matthias to rest would be the thing to help free her heart from this burden. She only knew she could not go on this way. She rose. "I'm ready," she said, though she knew it wasn't true. They rode out from camp, following the river. "Tell me a story, Matthias." She needed to hear him now, needed to know some part of him would remain with her. "Tell me about your family."
"Tell me about yours, Nina. Why did you never speak of them?"
"Because she'd never known them. She'd grown up in a foundling home not unlike the orphanage at Karemsin. There were no records of Nina's parents. She was one more child who had arrived without papers or history. Kalechka, as they called it, from the fruit crate. She'd been given the name of one of the home's patrons, and had worn donated clothes that arrived tied up in big sacks and smelling of the chemicals they were boiled in to make sure they were free of lice."
"Were you unhappy, Nina?"
"No, Matthias."
"It wasn't in your nature, even then."
"It is now," she thought. Whatever spark had burned in her was no match for this grief. But back then she hadn't been unhappy, despite the chores and the boring lessons and the meals that were mostly cabbage. There had always been noise and company and games to play. She had appointed herself the home's official greeter, welcoming new arrivals, helping to name the new babies, and offering up her rag doll, Feodora, to anyone who might need a friend on their first night in the dormitories. Besides, the staff always treated her kindly. "Come, little Nina, tell us the news," Baba Inessa would say, and seat Nina on a stool in the kitchen where she could suck on a bread crust and watch the women at their work. Nina had been just 7 years old when she'd met her first tyrant. His name was Tomek, and he changed everything at the foundling home. He wasn't the tallest or the strongest. He was simply the meanest, willing to strike and bite even the littlest orphans. If someone had a toy, he would break it. When a child was sleeping soundly, he would pinch them awake. He was all manners and dimples when the staff were near, but as soon as they were gone, cruel Tomek would return. As if they'd just been waiting for a leader, a group of bullies coalesced around him, boys and girls who had always seemed nice enough, until they developed a taste for others' tears. Nina did her best to avoid them. But it was as if Tomek could smell her happiness like smoke from a kitchen fire. One morning, just after the feast of Sankt Nikolai, Baba Inessa gave Nina an orange to share with the other children. Nina warned them to be silent, but they'd giggled and whooped until, of course, Tomek had marched over to investigate and snatched it from her hands. "Give it back!" she'd shouted as he dug his thumbs into the orange's waxy skin. "It's for everyone!" But Tomek and his friends had just jeered. "You're fat enough already," he'd said, and pushed her so hard she'd fallen on her backside. Tomek had shoved the whole orange into his mouth and bitten down, laughing as pulp and juice dribbled over his chin. He laughed even harder when, to Nina's great shame, she'd started crying.
"Look how red you are," Tomek said, his mouth still full. "You look like a rotten apple."
He and his friends crowded around Nina, poking her belly, her arms, her legs.
"Look how rotten she is."
Nina had been scared, but more than anything, she'd been angry. Curled up on the floor, she'd felt something in her shift. A long, luxurious stretch, like a cat yearning toward a sunbeam. All her breathlessness and fear rushed out of her, and it was as if she could feel Tomek's lungs as they expanded, contracted. She squeezed her fists tight.
"Look how..."
Tomek hiccuped. Then his friends hiccuped. It was funny, at first. They stopped poking Nina. They looked at one another and giggled, the sound broken by startled little huffs. They kept hiccuping.
"It hurts," said one, rubbing his chest. "I can't stop," said another,
bending double. It went on that way, all of them hiccuping and moaning long into the night, like an assembly of discontented frogs. Nina found she could do all kinds of things. She could soothe a crying infant. She could ease her own tummy ache. She could make Tomek's nose run, and run, and run, until his whole shirt was wet with snot. Sometimes she had to stop herself from doing anything too terrible. She didn't want to be a tyrant, too. Only a few months later, the Grisha examiners had come to the foundling home, and Nina had been taken to the little palace. "Goodbye," she'd called as she'd run through the halls, saying her farewells. "Goodbye. Write me lots of letters, please. And be nice," she'd warned Tomek. "She's a married child," Baba Inessa had told the Grisha woman in her red kefta. "Try not to break her of it."
"No one has, Nina. No one ever will."
"I'm not so sure, Matthias." War hadn't done it. Captivity, torture. But loss was something different. Because she saw no end to it, only the far horizon stretching on and on. Nina knew the spot as soon as she saw it. A copse of trees by the riverbank. A place where travelers might come to rest. And where the water eddied as if the river were resting too. "Here," she told herself as she dismounted and untied a shovel and pick from the sledge. "Here." It took her hours to dig. Adric couldn't help with the task, but he used his power to keep the wind from tearing at her clothes and to shelter the lantern when the sky began to dim. Nina wasn't certain how deep to dig, but she went on until she was sweating in her coat, until her hands blistered, and then until the blisters broke. When she stopped panting, Adric did not wait for her to signal but began to untie the tarp on the sledge. Nina made herself help him, forced herself to move aside the boxes and gear that hid their true cargo. "Here." Matthias was wrapped in linen specifically treated by the fabricators at the little palace to preserve him from decay, and reinforced by Leonie's craft. Nina thought of pulling the linen aside, of glimpsing his cherished face one more time. But she couldn't bear the idea of seeing his features still and cold, his skin gray. It was bad enough that she had the memory of his blood on her hands forever, the wound beneath her palms, his heart going still. Death was supposed to be her friend and ally, but death had taken him just the same. She could at least try to remember him as he'd been. Awkwardly, Nina and Adric rolled his body from the edge of the cart. It was huge and heavy. He tumbled into the tomb with a horrible thud. Nina covered her face with her hands. She had never been more grateful for Adric's silence. Lying in the well of the grave, Matthias's body looked like a chrysalis, as if he were at the beginning of something instead of the end. He and Nina never exchanged gifts or rings. They'd had no possessions they shared. They had been wanderers and soldiers. Even so, she could not leave him with nothing. From her pocket, she drew a slender sprig of ash and let it drift down into the grave, followed by a smattering of withered red petals from the tulips their compatriots had placed on his chest when they bid him goodbye in Ketterdam. "I know you never cared for sweets." Her voice wobbled as she let a handful of toffees fall from her hand. They made a hollow patter. "But this way, I'm with you, and you can keep them for me when I see you next. I know you won't eat them yourself." She knew what came now. A handful of earth. Another. "I love you," she told him, trying not to think of the graceless sound of the soil, like the rattle of shrapnel, like sudden bursts of rain. "I loved you." Her eyes blurred from the tears. She couldn't see him any longer. The earth rose higher. There would be snow soon, maybe even tonight. It would cover her work, a burial shroud, white and unmarred. And when spring came, the snow would melt and find its way through the soil and carry Matthias's spirit to the river, to Jell. He would be with his god at last. Will you take the sledge back to camp? She asked Adric.
There were still things she needed to say, but only to Matthias.
Adric nodded and glanced up at the darkening sky.
Just don't be too long. A storm's coming.
Good, she thought. Let the snow come soon. Let it cover our work here.
Nina knelt on the cold ground, listening to the hoofbeats of Adric's horse fade. She could hear the rush of the river, feel the damp of the earth through the heavy wool of her skirts. The water hears and understands. The ice does not forgive. Fjärden words. The words of Jill.
Matthias, she whispered,
then cleared her throat and tried again.
Matthias, she said more loudly. She wanted him to hear her, needed to believe he could.
Oh, saints, I don't want to leave you here. I don't want to leave you ever.
But that was not the hero's eulogy he deserved. She could do this for him.
Nina drew a long, shaky breath.
Matthias Helvar was a soldier and a hero. He saved me from drowning. He kept us both alive on the ice. He endured a year in the worst prison in the world for a crime he didn't commit. He forgave me for betraying him. He fought beside me. And when he could have abandoned me, he turned his back on the only country he'd ever known instead. For that, he was branded a traitor. But he wasn't. He believed his country could be more than it had been. He lived with honor, and died with it too.
Her voice broke and she forced the waver away from it. She wanted to be dignified in this moment. She wanted to give him that.
He wasn't always a good man, but he had a good heart. A great, strong heart that should have kept beating for years and years.
Little red bird. Let me go.
She wiped the tears from her eyes. This was the first half of her debt paid. She'd brought him home to the land he loved. There should be something to mark this moment, a bell to toll, a choir to sing for him, something so she knew it was time to say her last goodbye.
But you're not done yet, my love.
You and your sense of duty,
she said on a bitter laugh.
The whispers rose inside her head.
She didn't want to hear them now, not here.
Listen, Nina.
She did not want to, but she knew she could hide from them no longer. The voices of the dead calling to her down the mountain, through the town, over the ice. The voices of women, of girls, anguish in their hearts. Something had happened to them on that hilltop.
Help us, they cried. Hear us at last.
The words were clear now, and they were drowning out Matthias's voice.
Stop, she told them. Leave us alone. Leave me be.
But the dead did not relent.
Justice,
they demanded.
Justice.
This was no hallucination. It wasn't madness either. The chorus was real, and they had brought her here for a reason. Nina had hoped her mission with Adric and Leonie would be enough to start healing. It hadn't been. But the girls on the mountain would not be denied.
Justice.
They had brought her this far. And they needed her to listen to them, not the echo of a love she could not hold on to. Nina placed a hand to her heart then, as the ache inside her broke, the ice giving way. There was only dark water beneath, the terrible pain of knowing he was truly gone, the awful understanding that she would never hear his voice again. Because the chorus was real. But Matthias's voice was not. It never had been.
You were never here,
she whispered, the tears coming hard now.
You were never here.
All this time she had wanted to believe that he was still with her, but it had been her voice all along, talking herself through the silence, forcing herself to do the work of living when all she wanted was to let go.
Goodbye, Matthias.
No one answered.
she was alone in the silence.
Chapter 9. Nikolai.
We can call them back, said Zhenya, pacing before the fire. It's not too late. We send messengers and just tell the girls and their families there's been a change in plans.
They'd gathered in the war room this morning, and Nikolai had called for coffee instead of tea. He'd developed a taste for it during his university days in Ketterdam, though between his exhaustion and the headache that had plagued him since the incident in Balakirev the previous night, he wouldn't have minded something stronger in his cup. The incident. What a generous turn of phrase. Tolia had filled him in on every grim detail of his little display in the bell tower. He'd almost murdered one of his most valued generals, one of his only true friends, the person who had helped him to steer this cursed ship of a country for 2 years, who had kept his secrets and whom he had trusted to do so without question. He had almost killed Zoya.
"We'll tell them the king is unwell," continued Zhenya.
"That is the last thing we tell them," said Tamar.
"Then we tell them there's been an outbreak of cholera, or a massive sewage leak," said Tolia.
Tamar threw up her hands. "So our choices are looking indecisive, weak, or like the capital is swimming in excrement?" Zoya had been silent through the meeting thus far, hovering by the samovar with crossed arms, keeping her distance. He knew he needed to apologize to her, but for once in his ridiculous life, he was completely at a loss for words. And before he could wrestle with that particular failure, there was the problem of the party he had so cleverly planned, the one the demon within him seemed intent on crashing. Nikolai took another sip of bitter coffee, hoping it would clear his head.
"I think we may have a resource we didn't have before."
As if she could read his thoughts, Zoya's gaze snapped to his. "If you say that hideous flagpole of a monk, I will—
"Marvel at my ingenuity. Plant a fond kiss upon my cheek, put up a plaque to my genius."
"I will put a plaque on the palace wall, commemorating this date as the morning on which Nikolai Lansoff took leave of his senses. The boy is a lunatic, a zealot. He worships at the feet of a man who started a civil war and murdered half of the Second Army."
"He worships an ideal. It's something we've all been guilty of at one time or another."
Zoya turned away, but not before he saw the hurt on her face. Zoya Nazielensky did not flinch, but the pain had been unmistakable. Nikolai wanted to stop the meeting and just— he didn't know what exactly, but he did know that the correct response to almost killing someone was not to try to score points off them the next day.
"Then by all means," said Zoya, "let's welcome a former member of the priest guard into the war room and put our future in his grubby hands."
"Isn't she lovely when she agrees?" Nikolai asked, and savored Zoya's scowl.
It was so much better than seeing that stark, wounded look and knowing he had caused it. But a moment later, he was kicking himself as Tolia escorted the monk into the war room, and Zoya's grim expression turned to bemusement.
"Your Highness," said Yuri stiffly.
He was so tall he had to duck entering the room, and so slender he looked as if he might turn sideways and get carried away by a draft.
"I was warned of your glib tongue. You talk of breaking bread, but I spent last night confined to what amounts to a cell." "The iris suite? My aunt Ludmila decorated it herself. Overly fond of the color puce, but cell seems a bit ungenerous." "The color is fine. It's the armed guards that offend my sensibility. Is this how you treat all of your guests?"
"Tolia," whispered Nikolai, "I think he's calling you bad company."
He leaned back and rested his elbows on the arms of his chair.
"Yuri, you have enemies. Those guards were there for your protection."
Yuri sniffed.
"My followers will not stand for this."
And that was why Nikolai had sent bread, smoked cod, and some very fine kvass to the people camped outside the city, compliments of the crown. Men with full bellies complained less. In truth, Nikolai had meant to see Yuri yesterday, but the afternoon's business had gotten the better of his time. And as for the night, well,
That had certainly gotten the better of him, too.
Yuri, may I introduce?
No, you may not. I wish to speak on the matter of the Starless One, and—
Abruptly, Yuri straightened. His eyes widened, and his jaw went slack as he looked around the room and seemed to finally register where he was. He clasped his hands like a soprano about to sing.
Oh,
the monk gasped.
Oh, it's you. It's all of you.
He turned to the members of the triumvirate and bowed deeply.
Moi sovereigni, it's an honor.
He bowed a second time.
An absolute honor.
Down he went again.
A dream, really.
Nikolai suppressed a groan. Just what had he brought upon himself? Zoya and Zhenya exchanged a baffled glance, and even David looked up from his work long enough to frown in confusion.
Do stop that, Zoya said. You look like an oil derrick.
Commander Zoya Nazielensky, Yuri said on a strangled breath. Yesterday. I didn't realize. I thought you were just
one of the king's lackeys.
Zoya ignored Yuri's protests and said,
You do realize every member of this triumvirate fought against your beloved Starless Saint in the Civil War?
Yes, of course.
The monk pushed his wire-rimmed spectacles up the bridge of his long nose.
I do. But, well, David Kostik, the great fabricator who forged the first amplifier worn by Sancta Alina herself.
David looked at him blankly and returned to his reading.
Zoya Nazielensky, who was one of the Darkling's most favored soldiers.
Zoya's lip curled.
And then, of course, Zhenya Safin, the first tailor who bears the marks of the Darkling's blessing.
Zhenya flinched.
Blessing?
I beg your pardon? Said Zoya, already raising her hands to either summon a storm or to wring Yuri's neck. Tamar reached for her axes. Tolya actually growled. Nikolai rapped his knuckles against the table.
That's enough, everyone. Stand down. Yuri, you are trespassing in territory you cannot begin to understand.
Despite his height, the monk looked like little more than a gawky child who had broken his mother's favorite vase.
Forgive me, I meant no offense.
Slowly, Zhenya stood and silence fell around her.
How old are you, Yuri?
18, moi sovereigni.
When I was a year older than you, the Darkling set his monsters on me. Creatures born of the power you venerate so much. They had a taste for human flesh. He had to force them to stop.
Then he was not so cruel.
Zhenya held up a hand, and Nikolai was glad to see Yuri shut his mouth.
The Darkling didn't want me to die. He wanted me to live. Like this.
More fool him, said Nikolai quietly. To let such a soldier survive.
Zhenya gave the barest nod.
Think twice before you use the word blessing, monk.
She sat and folded her hands.
Proceed.
Just a moment,
David said, planting a finger on the page to mark his place in his book.
What was your name? Yuri Vedenin, moi sovereigni. Yuri Vedenin, if you upset my wife again, I will kill you where you stand.
The monk swallowed.
Yes, moi sovereigni.
Oh, David, Zhenya said, taking his hand. You've never threatened to murder anyone for me before.
Haven't I?
He murmured distractedly, placed a kiss on her knuckles, and continued reading.
Forgive me, I am overwhelmed.
Yuri sat, then rose again as if he couldn't help himself.
To think I'm in rooms built by the Starless One himself!
He touched his fingers to the black seams that marked the shadow fold on the map.
It is too glorious to contemplate. Is this cowhide?
Reindeer, I believe, said Nikolai.
Remarkable.
Wait,
said Zoya, blue eyes slitted.
You said the Starless One himself, not his ancestors.
Yuri turned from the map with a smug smile on his lips.
Yes, I did. I know there was only one Darkling, one man of great power who faked his death many times, a precaution against small minds who might have feared his extraordinary power and his long life.
And how did you arrive at this theory?
Asked Nikolai.
Yuri blinked.
It's not a theory. I know. The Darkling revealed as much to me in a vision.
Zoya's brows rose, and Nikolai had to fight the urge to roll his eyes. Instead, he tented his fingers and said,
I see.
But Yuri's smile just deepened.
I know you think me mad, but I have seen miracles.
And that was exactly why Nikolai had brought him here.
You said something the other day, that the age of saints was upon us. What did you mean?
How else do you account for the miracles taking place throughout Ravka?
So it begins, muttered Zoya.
We've heard the stories, said Nikolai mildly. But there are rational explanations for these occurrences. We live in difficult times, and people are bound to look for miracles.
To Nikolai's surprise, the young monk sat down at the table and leaned across it, his expression earnest.
Your Highness, I know you are not a man of faith, but the people believe these happenings are not just phenomena in search of explanation. They believe they are the work of saints.
They are the work of Grisha, said Zoya.
Possibly the shoe. Possibly your dear friend, the apparat.
Ah, said Yuri. But some people believe all of the old miracles were the work of Grisha.
Then call it the small science and dispense with all of this superstition.
Would that make it easier to accept the divine?
Yuri asked, his spectacles glinting.
If I call these works the making at the heart of the world, would that help? I've studied Grisha theory too.
Zoya's eyes were hard as gems.
I'm not here to debate theology with a mop handle.
Yuri sat back, his expression beatific.
The saints are returning to Ravka, and the Starless One will be among them.
The Darkling is dead, Jenya said,
and Nikolai did not miss the white knuckles of her clasped hands.
I watched his body burn.
Yuri cast a nervous glance at David and said,
There are some who believe the Darkling did not die on the fold and is simply awaiting his chance to return.
I was there too, monk, said Zoya. I saw him burn away to ash atop a funeral pyre fed by Inferni flame.
The monk closed his eyes briefly, pained.
Yes, of course. That was his martyrdom. And his body was destroyed. But the Darkling's power was extraordinary, ancient. It may be gone. Or it may still live on in the world, and his spirit with it.
Zoya pressed her lips together, folding her arms tightly against her body as if to keep away the cold. Nikolai did not like what he was hearing. A scrap of that ancient power still resided within his own body. And if last night was any indication, it was growing stronger by the day.
You think all of these separate incidents, these supposed miracles, are related to the Darkling? He asked.
No, exclaimed the monk. He leaned even farther forward.
In a moment, his chin was going to make contact with the table.
I know they are.
He rose and gestured to the map behind him.
If I may.
He looked around, darting right and left, robes flapping like the wings of a deranged bird.
This is what the Darkling's acolytes look like, whispered Zoya. If we'd left a body, he would be turning in his grave.
Aha!
Yuri said, finding the small cloth flags that could be pinned to the hides. The maps were pocked with tiny holes where former leaders had planned military campaigns.
The earthquake at Rivost, the statue at Semna, the roof of Myrrh at Arkesk, the bleeding walls in Udova, the roses in Adena.
One after another, he listed the supposed miracles as he put pins on the map. Then he stood back. They began here, far along the coasts and mountains and borders, but day by day, the occurrences have become more frequent, and they've drawn closer to... The fold, said Nikolai. The pattern was clear. A radiant starburst with its heart dead center in the unsee. Saints, breathed Zoya. Is that where? Jenya began. Yes, said Nikolai. Though he didn't remember much of the final battle, he'd been inflicted with the monster already, fighting with it for control of his consciousness, and winning far more often than he was now. He'd been lucid in long flashes, even in his transformed state, and had sought out help from Alina. He had even tried to aid their forces in that last confrontation. The miracle sites were closing in on the same central spot, the place where the fold had once been, where the Darkling had made his last stand, where he had faced Alina Starkov and died by her hand. Victory. At least that's what it had looked like at the time, a country united. The possibility of peace, and Nikolai suddenly and swiftly purged of the demon that had battled him for control. He had believed the darkness within him had been vanquished at the moment of the Darkling's death. He had believed the war was over. And yet the monster had risen up to take hold of him again. Had the demon always been there, troubling his dreams, his constant companion, awaiting its moment? Or had something woken it? Nikolai looked at the pins splayed over the map. Was there a pattern, or was Yori seeing what he wanted to? And was this seemingly guileless zealot playing a deeper game?
Forgive me, Yori, Nikolai said. But your goal is to have the Darkling recognized as a saint by the Ravkin Church. You have every reason to try to tie these occurrences to the Starless One.
I have no reason to lie, said Yori. Only days ago a sign appeared on the fold, a lake of black rock, a sun in eclipse. Zoya expelled an exasperated breath. Or a geological anomaly. Yori poked his bony finger at the map.
This is not just where the Starless One passed from this life. It is a place of ancient power, the very place the Darkling first ruptured the world and created the fold.
You can't possibly know that. Zoya said with a dismissive wave.
It was the subject of my studies in the Priest Guard. It's all in the texts.
Which texts? She asked. And Nikolai wondered if she was deliberately trying to bait the monk.
The Book of Alyosha. The Sikorian Psalms. You can see it illustrated in the Istori Sanctia.
A children's book.
It was a holy site, insisted Yori. The place where Sankt Felix was pierced by the apple boughs. An ancient place of healing and glorious power, where men came to be purified.
Nikolai sat up straighter.
Purified of what exactly?
Yori opened his mouth, closed it.
I misspoke. No, he didn't, said Tolia. He's talking about the Obispaya. Aren't you, monk?
I
hate to admit my ignorance, said Nikolai. It's so much more fun for people to discover it on their own. But what exactly is the Obis Bumpy?
No idea, said Zoya. Jenya shrugged, and even David shook his head. To Nikolai's surprise, it was Tamar who spoke.
The Obispaya, she said. The ritual of the burning thorn. Do you know how the priest card were first created?
Those are children's stories, said Zoya scornfully.
Possibly, Tolia conceded. Tell me a story then, said Nikolai.
Tamar folded her arms.
Why don't you do the honors, monk?
Yori hesitated, then said.
It begins with the first Lansoth king, Yaromir the Determined.
He shut his eyes, his voice taking on a more confident, even cadence.
Before him, the territory that would become Ravka was little more than a collection of warring provinces led by squabbling kings. He subdued them,
and brought them together beneath his double-eagle banner. But the invasions from Fierda to the north, and Shu Han